Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 189 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This is series 26. And this one is kind of, it's going to involve like some mixture of OB-GYN and, you know, many different things like OB-GYN, some internal medicine, some surgery. So, but this is actually a super high yield podcast. For those of you that are going to be taking the exam soon, this is a podcast you really want to pay attention to. So let's just jump right into it. And today I'm going to try to compare and contrast things that tend to be confusing for many people on MBME exams, right? So the first thing I want to compare and contrast is like focal nodular hyperplasia versus hepatic adenoma, right? So what are the big differences between those two things? Well, the thing is, you want to know that hepatic adenomas, they will typically set up the stage in a woman that, you know, takes OCPs or some kind of estrogen containing product on exams. That's one. Another thing you will find with hepatic adenoma, right, is that it does not, very high yield, it does not contain a central scar. Sometimes you may see the central scar referred to as a stellate scar on MBME exams. So if you don't see a central scar, you don't see a stellate scar, that's more likely to be a hepatic adenoma, okay? And then another thing is that the hepatic adenoma, right, if you do like a CT scan, during the arterial phase, you'll have something known as centripetal enhancement, okay? Centripetal enhancement on the arterial phase of a CT scan is indicative on an MBME exam of a person potentially having a hepatic adenoma. And then one unusual thing that people may see on the newer USMLE exams that may be a little bizarre is they may tell you about a HIDA scan in the context of a hepatic adenoma. It's actually important to remember that hepatic adenomas do not contain like bile duct epithelium, right? So because they don't contain like bile duct epithelium, so basically you essentially don't have a biliary tree within a hepatic adenoma. So the thing is, it would actually not give you any positive HIDA results, okay? It would not enhance on a HIDA scan. That's actually very high yield to know. It's a very unique difference from a focal nodular hyperplasia. So how is focal nodular hyperplasia set up? The big setup you want to think about is, again, they can tell you that it has like a central scar or stellate scar. They almost always put that on exam. That's one high yield thing to know. Second high yield thing to know is that FNH, when you do those CT scans, it has like a centrifugal, right? A centrifugal pattern of enhancement, right? So you kind of have like enhancement around the periphery versus centripetal, where you're like going, like enhancing from the outside and going towards the center, okay? So a centrifugal pattern of enhancement on the arterial phase is pathognomonic of FNH on exams. And remember, F in centrifugal for the F in focal nodular hyperplasia, right? That's another high yield thing to know. And then FNH is actually important to remember that it contains like biliary duct epithelium. So it's actually positive on a HIDA scan. That's a unique difference from a hepatic adenoma. Now, the next thing I want to compare and contrast is the different kinds of hernias, right? Especially in relation to like the diaphragm, right? So the thing is, remember that we have like the sliding hiatal hernias, right? Those can increase a person's risk of like GERD, right? But in a sliding hiatal hernia, it's critical to remember on exams that the GE junction is part of what herniates into the esophagus, right? Compare and contrast that with a paraesophageal hernia, where the GE junction actually stays in its normal place. It's the fundus of the stomach that herniates into the through the diaphragm, right? And it's very important to remember that paraesophageal hernias, you don't observe those. You actually go ahead and send those people to surgery, okay? You actually go ahead and send those people to surgery because paraesophageal hernias have a very high risk of incarceration and subsequent strangulation, right? Remember, there are two kinds of hernias that you don't really observe like you do for many of the others. And that's one, paraesophageal hernia, and then two, a femoral hernia, right? Remember, a femoral hernia being a female on MBME exams, and it's going to be under the inguinal ligament and medial to the femoral vessels, okay? Very high yield to know that. So that's how you compare and contrast the paraesophageal hernia with a sliding hiatal hernia. Now, the next concept I want to talk about is a construct that shows up quite a bit on MBMEs, but people seem to get wrong. One thing I want you to keep in mind is if you have chronic inflammation in an organ, right, like a hollow organ, you can actually form strictures within that organ that can cause obstructive-like symptoms. So let's sort of go from head to toe in the body to talk about like key areas where this concept tends to pop up. One is if a person has a history of chronic GERD, that can cause strictures in their esophagus, right? And they can have signs and symptoms of dysphagia, okay? They can have signs and symptoms of dysphagia because, again, all those strictures from the chronic inflammation of GERD, right, can cause those strictures, and they'll have like a solid food dysphagia on NBM exams. Next one, if you go a little lower in the GI tract, is Crohn's disease, right? So again, Crohn's, right, again, it's typically accompanied by a ton of inflammation. So all that inflammation can certainly cause problems with, cause like obstructive style symptoms, okay? So if you see a person that has a history of Crohn's and maybe is not on medication, or they recently tapered their medication or whatever, and then you're like, man, this person has like signs and symptoms of a small bowel obstruction, think about Crohn's disease causing strictures in the small bowel that's then causing small bowel obstructive style symptoms. And then the last one I want to get to is if they give you a question about a person, you know, this person has like very risky sexual behaviors, and then, you know, this person has had many episodes of PID, and then this person is having like, you know, like amenorrhea problems or problems becoming pregnant, think about potential strictures occurring in that person's uterus, okay? That's essentially Asherman's syndrome, okay? Asherman's syndrome. Or if a person has had like a lot of DNCs for like, you know, like recurring abortions or whatever, right? That's Asherman's syndrome, right? That's essentially like a strictural disorder of the uterus, right? And typically the way you make the diagnosis of strictures of the uterus is that you do like, you can do something like, you can do something known as a saline infusion sonohysterography. It's almost like an ultrasound, but you inject water into the cavity of the uterus as contrast. That's one thing you can do. Or you can also do like hysteroscopy, right? And inject contrast and just take like x-ray images. And then the way you treat Asherman's syndrome, obviously, right, is to hysteroscopically lyse those adhesions, right? And then you give them estrogen to build up that endometrium and their problems kind of go away. So those are the structural disorders I want you to keep in mind for purposes of the USMLEs. Now, what if they give you a question about a person, you know, that has like a skin condition on extensor surfaces, and they tell you that, oh, it has like silvery scale. What are you thinking about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about psoriasis on NBME exams. The main thing I want to focus on with psoriasis is the treatment, because this is something that people on, like your friends at the NBME, they would like you to confuse this with the treatment of acne. Right? Psoriasis is treated in a somewhat different fashion from acne. So let's talk about some quick things here. Your first line treatment strategy for psoriasis is to use a topical agent, right? So what could these topical agents be, right? Topical agents, you can use things like topical steroids, right? Remember, you actually do not use topical steroids for acne, right? So you can use topical steroids for, so first line, you can use topical agents for psoriasis. What does first line, what do these topical agents include? You can use anything from like topical corticosteroids like clobetasol, or you can use like topical coal tar, right? Or you can use like a topical vitamin D analog. A classic one you may see on an exam is something known as calcipotriene. Remember, right, vitamin D, like there's vitamin D analogs that are known as like calcidiol, calcitriol. So memorizing the term calcipotriene, right, should not be that big of a stretch, right? So that's first line, topical agents. Now, your second line agents for psoriasis, right? In addition to the topical agents, you then add on it. I almost think of it as almost like step-up therapy like you do for asthma, right? So if topical agents are not cutting for a person, you retain those topical agents, but you then add a systemic agent, right? You add a systemic agent like methotrexate or cyclosporine. Very high yield to know that. Those are your second line add-on agents for a person that has psoriasis. Now, your third line agents, you can use biologics, right? Like your infliximab, adalimumab, etanercept, so your TNF-alpha inhibitors. Alternatively, you can actually use phototherapy, right? You can use like UVB phototherapy, not UVA, UVB phototherapy, or you can use something known as PUVA, right? PUVA, P-U-V-A, just remember the term PUVA. Although remember that subjecting yourself to PUVA increases the person's risk of a squamous cell carcinoma of the skin, okay? So that's third line for the treatment of psoriasis. Compare and contrast this with acne, where your first line treatment for acne is, again, you can use a topical agent, you can use like a topical retinoid or topical salicylic acid or topical benzoyl peroxide, right? If that's not cutting it, you can then jump to like a topical antibiotic, right? Like topical like clindamycin or something. If that's not working, you go to an oral antibiotic, right? Again, like oral clindamycin or oral doxycycline. It'll probably be oral doxycycline that'll be the right answer on your exam. And then if that's not cutting it, you need to make sure, do a pregnancy test, make sure the person is not pregnant, check their LFTs, make sure their livers work well, right? And then you go ahead and start them on isotretinoin. Remember, if you're on isotretinoin, you need to be on two forms of birth control, because isotretinoin is certainly a teratogen. And then one last thing I'll go ahead and say with psoriasis is, again, they can give you a bizarre question and say, in a patient with psoriasis, which is the most likely mental health complication of this disorder? It's actually depression, right? Major depressive disorder is very common in patients that have a long history of psoriasis, right? Which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, like, if a person has this skin condition that's kind of like chronic, kind of hard to treat, right? It will make sense that they won't feel good all the time, right? So that's one weird thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, let's real quick talk about the three different kinds of shock, but I want to talk about them in the context of cardiac output, like effects on cardiac output, effects on systemic vascular resistance, and effects on pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, right? So if a person has like an MI, right, what kind of shock will they have? Well, obviously, they'll have a cardiogenic style shock, right? So if a person has cardiogenic shock, well, the heart is not working very well anymore. If your heart is not working very well anymore, what should be true of the cardiac output? It should be decreased, right? Okay. And if the cardiac output is decreased, what should happen to the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure? It should be increased, right? Because remember, PCWP is a proxy, right, for left atrial pressure. So this person will have elevated left atrial pressures, which will be manifested as elevated pulmonary capillary wedge pressures on MBM exams, right? And if this person with cardiogenic shock happens to have pulmonary edema, right, you would expect that the PCWP should be greater than 18, right? Because this is a cardiogenic source of pulmonary edema. Compare and contrast that with ARDS, where people have a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, okay? Very high yield to know that for tests. And then finally, right, I mean, obviously, if a person's cardiac output is in the toilet, then they are not perfusing their organs very well. Their blood pressures will be very low. So the way the body tries to adjust is to try to clamp down on their blood vessels, so they will have elevated systemic vascular resistance. Again, very high yield to know that, right? And cardiogenic shock, obviously, right, you want to give that person a positive inotrope like digoxin, or you want to give something like dobutamine, right, or murinone to help with the cardiogenic shock. Now, if a person has septic shock, right, the primary event in septic shock is that this person has the release of inflammatory mediators, right? So those people will have like systemic vasodilation, right? They'll have systemic vasodilation. So if you have systemic vasodilation, what should that do to your afterload? That should crush the afterload. If your afterload goes down, what happens to your cardiac output? Your cardiac output will go up, okay? So cardiac output is elevated in a person that has septic shock. And if your cardiac output is up, what should be true of the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure in septic shock? Well, it should be low, right? Because again, if your heart is working well, then that means you will not have retention of stuff in the left atrium. So the PCWP is low in a person that has septic shock, right? And the systemic vascular resistance, it should make sense that it should be low as well, because as I already said, right, septic shock, you have a release of like histamine and bradykinin and all those inflammatory mediators. Those things cause vasodilation, okay? Those things cause vasodilation, right? So ultimately, the person will have a decrease in systemic vascular resistance. And remember that one common pulmonary complication of sepsis is ARDS. Basically, if a person has like a systemic inflammatory disorder and they ask you what is the most likely complication of blah, 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 you want to think about ARDS under those circumstances. And then the last kind of shock I want to talk about, right? What if a person has like a massive, massive, massive GI bleed, right? What kind of shock will those people have? Well, I hope you're telling me that they have hypovolemic shock, okay? The characteristic feature of hypovolemic shock is that they have decreased blood volume, right? So their preload goes down. Right? So if a person has decreased preload, what happens to their end diastolic volume? It should go down, right? And if the EDV goes down, then what ultimately happens to their cardiac output? It should go down as well, right? So cardiac output is low in a person that has hypovolemic shock. And if the cardiac output is, but notice the cardiac output is not low because the heart does not work. The cardiac output is low because the heart is not getting enough blood. The heart is not getting enough preload, okay? So the cardiac output is low in hypovolemic shock. But the PCWP is also low in hypovolemic shock because there's just literally no blood in the heart, right? The reason I'm emphasizing these differences is that if a person has cardiogenic shock, their cardiac output is low, but because their hearts do not work, their PCWP is high. Compare and contrast this with hypovolemic shock, where the person's cardiac output is low, but their PCWP is low because it's not a cardiac problem that's causing the cardiac output to be low. Very high yield to understand that. And obviously, if a person has hypovolemic shock, and again, their blood pressure is very low, they're not perfusing their organs, right? Then the thing that's going to happen is that their systemic vascular resistance is going to increase to try to prop up blood pressures. And obviously, if a person has hypovolemic shock, you start with giving the person fluids first, not blood, fluids, right? Crystalloid first. And then if that's not cutting it, you can then go ahead and add in blood. And then for septic shock, as I mentioned, you can treat with norepinephrine, right? Norepinephrine is the pressor of choice for septic shock. If that's not cutting it, you can then go ahead and add vasopressin. But again, remember, before you start norepinephrine for septic shock, you must have given the person antibiotics and you must have given them fluids. And they must not have responded to those fluids before you can then jump to initiating pressors. Again, please, please, please make sure this is something you absolutely understand. So again, the hallmark of cardiogenic shock is the person's heart does not work, okay? The hallmark of septic shock is the person has systemic vasodilation. And then the hallmark of hypovolemic shock is that the person has low preload, okay? Now, let's talk about some risk factors for common malignancies. I mean, I've kind of talked about this in prior podcasts, but again, every sort of repetition always helps for sure. So, what is the most important, or you can say the biggest risk factor for breast cancer? That's age, right? And remember, right, in breast cancer, people can have like problems with like double-stranded DNA break repair, right? Like in the BRCA mutations, or if a person has like Lynch syndrome, right? That's more a problem with like mismatch repair. So don't mix those up. Mismatch repair problems, that's Lynch syndrome, aka HMPCC, right? Like hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, versus double-stranded DNA break repair. That's more with the BRCA mutations that underlie breast cancer. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for squamous cell carcinoma of like the penis or cervical cancer or squamous cell carcinoma of the vulva or whatever? What is the biggest risk factor? Well, I hope you're telling me about HPV, right? HPV is the biggest risk factor for most of the squamous cell carcinomas that we find in like the lower genital tract. Okay, now what is the biggest risk factor for endometrial cancer? Well, I hope you're telling me unopposed estrogen. Remember, there is a big difference between unopposed estrogen and opposed estrogen. Unopposed estrogen is straight estrogen. Opposed estrogen is estrogen that is conjugated with progestin, right? If you have estrogen conjugated with progestin, that does not increase a person's risk of endometrial cancer. But if you have just straight unopposed estrogen from either like PCOS or you're taking like hormone replacement therapy that does not include progestin, then that can certainly raise a person's risk of endometrial cancer, right? And it's actually important to remember that if a person has a history of breast cancer, they should not be taking any kind of OCP, right? Because OCP, remember, many breast cancers are ER/PR positive, right? So those things can spruce, because I mean, literally, OCPs contain estrogen and progestin, right? So those can activate those breast cancers and cause them to proliferate some more, right? So you don't want that. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for lung cancer? That's easy, right? That's smoking, okay? Now, what's the biggest risk factor for ovarian cancer? Well, that's like age, right? Ovarian cancer is much more common in older women. And also having a family history of ovarian cancer is definitely a big risk factor for ovarian cancer. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for papillary thyroid cancer? That's actually exposure of radiation, right, to the head and neck, right? Like prior history of like head and neck radiation exposure, probably a person that had like some kind of like lymphoma in childhood that you treated with radiation therapy, or breast cancer in childhood, not in childhood, but you know, some kind of breast cancer, and then they got like radiation therapy and then they got into trouble in the future with papillary thyroid cancer. And remember, papillary thyroid cancer has those anti-anion nuclei, and it also has like the sarcoma bodies, right? Kind of like you have with like mesothelioma and meningioma and serous adenocarcinoma of the ovaries. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for Burkitt's lymphoma? Well, that's EBV, right? That's EBV. Remember, Burkitt's lymphoma has the 814 translocation. Remember that your CML has the 922 translocation. Remember your acute promyelocytic leukemia, right? Your AML has the 1517 translocation. And then don't forget that your Ewing sarcoma has the 1122 translocation, where you create that EWS-FLI fusion protein. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for renal cell carcinoma? Well, I hope you're thinking about smoking, right? If you see a person with bilateral renal cell carcinomas, I would hope you think about a VHL, von Hippel-Lindau, with that. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for bladder cancer? That is also smoking as well, right? And then finally, what's the biggest risk factor for pancreatic cancer? That would be smoking as well, right? So again, hopefully, at least with this quick run through with these different malignancies, you know your different risk factors. Now, the next thing I think I want to compare and contrast for us is the difference between growing pains and osteoid osteoma. This is something that seems to confuse people quite a bit on MBM exams, okay? So growing pains, the key thing you want to remember is that growing pains tend to be bilateral, right? they tend to be bilateral. Like this child will have problems in both lower extremities, right? So they tend to be bilateral. The pain is usually worse at night, and it's usually worsened by a person having a ton of physical activity during the day, okay? So bilateral, worse at night, worsened by a ton of physical activity during the day, especially in a person that's undergoing like a big growth spurt. Think about growing pains, right? It's a pain that arises because you're growing, right? Now, compare and contrast it with osteoidosteoma. Osteoidosteoma is unilateral. They won't have bilateral symptoms. They'll be unilateral, okay? And the problem with osteoidosteoma is that they'll have pain at night, kind of like growing pains, but they'll put the term that it's relieved with NSAIDs, because the thing is, apparently prostaglandins, like an increase in prostaglandins plays a role in the pathophysiology behind the pain that's experienced in people that have osteoidosteoma, okay? So if you give an NSAID, NSAIDs are COX inhibitors, so that would downgrade the levels of prostaglandins, and that will help with that disorder. And the thing is, people that have osteoidosteomas, they may have like a bony prominence on physical exam or on imaging, on the MBME. So again, growing pains, bilateral, pain worse at night, worsened by a ton of physical activity during the day. Osteoidosteoma, unilateral, pain at night, relieved with NSAIDs, and they may have a bony prominence on physical exam or on imaging. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, because again, this is just something that does not, again, it's a common thing, so you think that people will, you know, have this down pat by now, but unfortunately, people don't have this stuff down pat just yet. So let me kind of talk about it and compare and contrast them, right? So there are three biliary pathologies you do not want to confuse on your MBME exams: cholecystitis, ascending cholangitis, and cholecystitis. So let me give you these things as like a set of three equations. For cholecystitis, think about it on an exam as fever and right upper quadrant pain only. So fever plus right upper quadrant pain is cholecystitis. Fever plus right upper quadrant pain plus jaundice is ascending cholangitis. I mean, that's the classically described Charcot's triad, right? Like fever, right upper quadrant pain, jaundice. If you add altered mental status and hypotension to that, you know you're dealing with Raynaud's pentad. Now, cholecystitis, on the other hand, is a person having right upper quadrant pain that may be mild plus jaundice. They do not have fevers on MBME exams. Again, it's very important to know. So fever plus right upper quadrant pain, cholecystitis. Fever plus right upper quadrant pain plus jaundice, ascending cholangitis. Right upper quadrant pain that's usually mild plus jaundice is cholecystitis. So you may say, Divine, why do people that have cholecystitis not have jaundice? Well, think about it. If a person has cholecystitis, the obstruction is at the level of the cystic duct, right? You're not specifically obstructing any part of the person's biliary tree, right? So because you're not blocking any part of the biliary tree, the person is highly unlikely to have jaundice, okay? But in cholecystitis and ascending cholangitis, the obstruction is at the level of the common bowel duct, right? So obviously those people are going to have jaundice. Now, remember that for cholecystitis, right, your first step in diagnosis is a right upper quadrant ultrasound, right? If the right upper quadrant ultrasound is equivocal or it doesn't show you what you want, then you go ahead and go with a Hyder scan and you treat with a cholecystectomy. For cholecystitis, your first step in diagnosis, you can do a right upper quadrant ultrasound. If that's equivocal or not showing you what you want, you can do an ERCP or an MRCP. Either or is just fine. But for ascending cholangitis, you jump straight to the ERCP. You don't do a right upper quadrant ultrasound for ascending cholangitis. And obviously, you're going to give those people antibiotics. And remember, people that have ascending cholangitis, right, you do not do a cholecystectomy during the acute phase. You do it, you know, like a while after the episode of cholangitis has resolved. Again, very important to know that for exams. Now, the next things I want to compare and contrast, or I guess maybe talk about in terms of a gradation, are these biliary tract disorders that pop up in pregnancy, right? So I think I want to differentiate between intrahepatic cholestasis versus acute fatty liver of pregnancy versus HELLP syndrome. HELLP syndrome is probably easiest for most people to recognize on exams, right? They'll have like hemolysis, right? So they'll have like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? They will have schistocytes on a blood smear, right? So HELLP syndrome, hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, so their liver enzymes will be elevated, right? And then they'll have a thrombocytopenia, low platelets, right? Contrast that with intrahepatic cholestasis. Intrahepatic cholestasis, right? Those people will have more of an obstructive jaundice style picture. classically on NBMA exams, those people have a ton of excoriation, like a ton of itching, right? And they'll have like a direct hyperbilirubinemia, okay? Direct, or you can say conjugated hyperbilirubinemia. And in addition to that, they'll have like an elevation in their alkaline phosphatase. Their AST and ALT will not be significantly elevated, if it's elevated at all, right? Contrast that with acute fatty liver of pregnancy, where these people will have like markedly elevated AST, ALT. They'll have like many signs of like bad liver. It's almost like a person being a cirrhotic, like bad end-stage liver disease. Like they'll have like hypoglycemia. They'll have like elevation in their PT, PTT. Their AST, ALT will be like through the roof, will be like super high, right? And the person just will not be doing well. Like, and it'll be something that happens acutely. That's why it's called acute fatty liver of pregnancy. Okay, and again, remember your other, like, I guess, hypertensive related disorders of pregnancy, like gestational hypertension shows up after like 20 weeks, right? So if it's before 20 weeks on an NBMA exam, it's not gestational hypertension, right? And remember, it's defined as blood pressures being greater than 140 over 90, right? And then if a person has that hypertension, and then they have proteinuria, and that proteinuria, the definition is having more than 300 milligrams of protein in the urine in a 24-hour period. If you see that, then that's preeclampsia. So hypertension plus proteinuria, right, is preeclampsia. And then eclampsia is when they have all those things, okay, but they now have seizures. And obviously, you treat those seizures with magnesium. And if a person has a hypertensive disorder in pregnancy, remember that the drugs that are available to you are drugs like hydralazine, alpha-methyl-DOPA, labetalol, and nifedipine. Remember, there's a mnemonic for that hypertensive moms love nifedipine, right? So you can use hydralazine, so hypertensive, and then moms, M, alpha-methyl-DOPA, and then L, labetalol, and then N, nifedipine, okay? Nifedipine. And if they want to kind of like mess with your head and say, oh, do you know the difference between like regular preeclampsia and preeclampsia with severe features? Well, preeclampsia with severe features, those people will have like signs and symptoms of like altered mental status. They'll have like low platelets, so they'll have a thrombocytopenia. Or if you see a person that has preeclampsia and their blood pressure systolic is more than 160, or their blood pressure diastolic is more than 110, that qualifies for preeclampsia with severe features, okay? And again, if a person is having like preeclampsia or severe features, you want to start thinking about delivery in some way, shape, or form. If the person is less than 34 weeks, you know, go ahead and give them like betamethasone, two doses in a 24-hour period, right? And then proceed towards delivery. But if they're more than 34 weeks, just go ahead and deliver the baby, okay? If they're more than 34 weeks, just go ahead and deliver the baby. Now, the other thing I think I want to differentiate between is the difference between something called an ectopic pregnancy and something called a blighted ovum. That's again another problem that people seem to kind of get hung up with on NBMA exams. An ectopic pregnancy by definition is not in the uterus. I'll say that again. An ectopic pregnancy by definition is not in the uterus. It did not implant in the uterus. That's why it's called an ectopic pregnancy in the first place. Again, remember the word ectopic. Ectopic means something is coming from or is situated where it's not supposed to be, right? So like kind of like ectopic ACTH, right? Oh, it's like, oh, ACTH comes from the anterior pituitary, but we're getting it from this small cell lung cancer that's in the lungs, right? That's ectopic ACTH. So an ectopic pregnancy is in a different spot from where it should normally be. Now, a blighted ovum, by definition, is an ovum that actually implants in the uterus. Very high yield. A blighted ovum implants in the uterus. So you will have a gestational sac. But for whatever reason, an embryo does not develop inside that gestational sac. If you see that, that's a blighted ovum, okay? Blighted is B-L-I-G-H-T-E-D. A blighted ovum, it actually does implant in. So it's an egg that, you know, gets fertilized. It implants in the uterus, right? But for whatever reason, no embryonic tissue develops from that, okay? Sometimes they may call it like an anembryonic pregnancy on an NBMA exams, on an NBMA exam, because that's one, right? To kind of mess with your head on tests. So again, gestational sac, no baby inside it, implanted in the uterus, blighted ovum. Ectopic pregnancy by definition is not in the uterus. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is hyperemesis gravidarum, right? So hyperemesis gravidarum, very high yield disorder to know. Remember, right, it will be a woman, usually first trimester, you know, just throwing up a ton, can't keep anything down. Obviously, for those people, you go ahead and admit them to the hospital. You put them on like, you know, give them IV hydration, IV antiemetics, on Dancitran, right? And then you want to supplement their vitamin B1, so like thiamine, and vitamin B6, right? The vitamin B6 is more like chronic supplementation. You tell them like, oh, take like B6 plus doxylamine and then eat small meals. But in the acute phase, when they come into the hospital, go ahead and give those people IV thiamine. Okay, that's another indication for IV thiamine treatment on MBM exams besides Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, right? And remember that people that have hyperemesis gravidarum, they classically have like ketosis, right? They may have like ketones elevated in their blood or in the urine on MBME tests. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is cervical incompetence. Again, this is a concept that people seem to be struggling with a lot on MBME exams, right? The thing is, if they ask you about like risk factors, right? Like in my OB-GYN video, I clearly talk about like, you know, a history of like a LEAP procedure or like a cervical colonization procedure. So LEAP procedure, L-E-E-P, right? Like a LEAP procedure or cervical colonization procedure, right? But there are some other things that on an MBME, especially like the newer exams, like the newer USMLE Step 2 CK exam, it kind of seems to make you, want you to remember. Right, so things like if a person has like a connective tissue disorder, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, that is a risk factor for cervical incompetence. If a person has also been exposed to like diethylstilbestrol, okay, that, believe it or not, that's also a risk factor for cervical incompetence. Because the thing is, I mean, again, if you look on Reddit or on SDN or whatever, people's common complaints with the current USMLE exams is that you read the question, as you're reading the question, you're like, yeah, I think I know what they're talking about. And then you look at the answers, you're like, man, I don't see anything that relates to anything I know, right? Or they give you a common pathology you're aware of, but they present it to you in an uncommon fashion, right? That's why, if you notice, I've been going a little bit off the reservation in my more recent podcast to kind of try to combat those needs. And again, for people that are going to be taking the exam soon, you absolutely need to listen to episode 184. Okay, on the website before you take, like, I mean, it's a given that you should listen to episodes 37 and 97, but episode 184 is, I almost think of it as like the third part of the risk factors trilogy. In episode 184, I talk about like, oh, like, what is the most common complication, what is the most likely outcome of this disorder, or like some weird screening guidelines. So like, oh, what additional finding would you expect on further workup of the patient, right? Or what's the most likely psychiatric complication of this, right? Like those weird kind of like risk factor stuff, like complications, like biggest prognostic factor and things like that, that I did not cover in 37 and 97. I cover them very thoroughly in episode 184. That is a floridly high yield podcast to listen to for the new USMLE Step 2 CK exam. So cervical incompetence, right? Again, like, you know, your LEAP colonization procedures, but having a connective tissue disorder like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome increases your risk. Being exposed to diethylstilbestrol increases your risk. Having a history of like preterm delivery also increases your risk for cervical incompetence, right? And the classic way it will present is, it will present as like, this woman will not have contractions, right? But they'll tell you that, oh, that they are seeing like the fetus, like in the vagina or whatever, right? Like in the second trimester, it's a painless second trimester pregnancy loss. And really, how do you treat cervical incompetence? You can do something like a cerclage, right? You can do like a cervical cerclage. And then if a person has a history of cervical incompetence for future pregnancies, one thing you can actually do is you can try to supplement with like vaginal progestin to kind of beef up the lining of the cervix. That will somewhat decrease the person's risk of cervical incompetence. Okay, now, one other weird, bizarre concept I think I want to talk about is people always seem to wonder, and actually it's not something you should just wonder about, it's something you should actually care about, especially if you're like a, you know, like a reproductive age female, like a young female, like a teenager basically, or, you know, like you're in your early 20s, 30s, whatever, or you're taking any of the USMLEs, right? That's probably your bigger concern with this. Well, there is this concept known as cervical ectopy. So let me go ahead and talk about it. So it's called cervical ectopy. Sometimes on MBME exams, they may call it like a cervical ectropion. So ectropion, right? So cervical ectopy. So let's talk about this thing. So the thing is, there are two major parts of the cervix. There's the endocervix and there is the ectocervix. The endocervix is lined by columnar epithelium. I'll say that again. The endocervix is lined by columnar epithelium. On the flip side, the ectocervix is lined by stratified squamous epithelium. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure it is stratified squamous keratinized epithelium, right? So think about it. Between those two kinds of epithelium, which one is more sturdy? Which one provides better protection, if you may? Well, I hope you're telling me that it's the stratified squamous keratinized epithelium that should provide better protection. I mean, that's literally the kind of epithelium that you find on your skin, right? So the thing is, the epithelium that we find in the ectocervix is very resistant to infection. But the columnar epithelium that we see in the endocervix is actually not very resistant to infection, like, at all, right? So the thing is, obviously, if you're a female, I mean, like, it should then make physiologic sense. Maybe before I say my next point, let me say it this way. It should then make physiologic sense as to why the endocervix, I mean, it's called endo, so it's on the inside. It should then make physiologic sense why the endocervix is more on the inside versus the ectocervix that is more on the outside, okay? That's one high yield thing to know. So think about it. If you're a female and you're like, man, I don't want to be getting all these STIs and all this stuff, well, you would not want your endocervix to see the outside world in any way, shape, or form, right? So the thing is, if for whatever reason you are in a state as a female where big chunks of your endocervix are kind of hanging out to the outside world, right? They're kind of like staying in the place where you would expect your ectocervix to be, then that person will have a very high risk of STIs, right? So the reason I'm explaining this stuff is that that's actually the mechanism behind young females being most, because think about it, right? Who do you typically see on MBM exams classically get STIs? It's almost always in a young female, right? I mean, yeah, do old people do risky things? Yes, they do, right? But let's just say old people don't do risky things on MBME exams, right? So the thing is, because young people in general, they like, okay, let me put it this way. As you get older, your endocervix begins to go more and more inwards. So as you are young, like when a woman is young, or if a woman uses like a ton of OCPs, that actually increases her risk of having that endocervix hang out closer to the outside world than it should be, right? And that will certainly raise that person's risk of a lot of like cervicitis and all these STIs. So again, I hope that's a concept that makes sense. Ectopy, right? Again, something being ectopic means it's where it should not be, okay? So your endocervix should be inside. But if you're seeing more and more of it on the outside because you're just a young female or because you take a ton of OCPs, right? Then that will make you more susceptible to infections of your genital tract. Now, one other thing that, again, has seemed to pop up quite a bit on the current USMLEs that give people a lot of trouble is this whole concept of amnioinfusion, right? The whole concept of amnioinfusion. So let's talk about it, right? Let's talk about this. So the thing is, amnioinfusion has three indications on the USMLE exams. One is if a woman has, a ton of variable D cells, right? That tells you that you're likely dealing with cord compression. You can use an amnioinfusion for that. Because think about it. Why would you get cord compression? Well, if you have a ton of oligohydramnios, right? The baby's body is more likely banging on the umbilical cord, right? So the thing is, if you were to put like some fluid into the amniotic sac, right? That would almost like put the baby in a bubble so that it doesn't keep banging into the umbilical cord, okay? So amnioinfusion is indicated for variable D cells, again, cord compression, right? Or if a person has like very severe oligohydramnios, that's like the second indication, like very severe oligohydramnios, and then they ask you the question, which of the following measures should be taken to decrease this woman's risk of cord compression as a complication of pregnancy, right? Think about amnioinfusion under those circumstances. And then the third indication, it's more of a soft indication, but it's an indication you certainly want to know for purposes of the USMLE exams, is having like a meconium, right? Like to decrease the risk of meconium aspiration syndrome. And this is classically something you'll find in a woman that is like post-term or close to post-term on MBM exams, right? So like a woman that's, you know, still pregnant and she's like 40 weeks, 41 weeks, 42 weeks on an MBM exam, right? So the thing here is, think about it. What is meconium? Let's maybe start there. What is meconium? Well, meconium is your first poop as a kid. And the thing is, you're supposed to poop within the first 48 hours of life, right? So the thing is, if a baby kind of expects, it's like, oh, you know what? Let's say the baby's telling all these little buddies in baby world that, you know what? I'm going to get out of my mom's uterus by, like, you know, like 38, 39 weeks, and I can go and, you know, poop and live a free life in the world. Well, if the baby is now like hanging out, it's like, man, it's like 40 weeks, 41 weeks, 42 weeks. It's like, you know what? I can't hold this anymore. And then it kind of poops on itself, right? Basically, pooping on itself is like pooping into the amniotic fluid. Well, the thing is, that usually doesn't cause many problems, but it can be bad. Because in the process of delivery, if the baby inhales that meconium, right, that can cause meconium aspiration syndrome. It can cause like persistent pulmonary hypertension. It can cause like problems, right? So if you want to try to avoid that, you can actually do an amnio infusion, right? That amnio infusion, at least the way I think about it, is it will almost like solubilize the meconium so that that will decrease the child's risk of aspirating it. Like if you look at certain guidelines, actually doing this amnio infusion to prevent MAS is actually not really indicated, right? But it's just one of those recommendations that I feel like the NBMEs test classically. So it's something you want to keep in mind. So you can actually, in NBME world, lower a child's risk of meconium aspiration syndrome by doing an amnio infusion. Now, the last thing I think I'll talk about, sorry, I know this is this is supposed to be a rapid review podcast, but the thing is, I just want to get through certain things because I want to get them out. I don't want to delay because this could be something that is vital for a person's exam. So I want to get it out right now. So the last thing I will talk about is this unique bug, okay? It's a bug that doesn't get a lot of fanfare in review resources, but it's a very, very high yield bug to know for the USMLE exams, right? And it's this bug known as Ureaplasma urolyticum. I'll say that again. Ureaplasma, Ureaplasma, urolyticum. Ureaplyticum, right? So Ureaplasma urolyticum, okay? So the thing is, if they give you a question about like a sexually active young female that, you know, has UTIs, think about Ureaplasma urolyticum as a potential cause. Although, right, you want to think about E. coli as the most common cause, and then you want to think about Staph saprophyticus as the second most common cause. But if you don't see E. coli as an answer choice, or you don't see Staph saprophyticus as an answer choice, I would want you to go with Ureaplasma urolyticum. That's one. Second thing you want to keep in mind with Ureaplasma urolyticum, and this is actually like something that's like ridiculously high yield to know for the USMLEs, is the fact that Ureaplasma urolyticum can actually be a cause of chorioamnionitis on NBME exams, right? So if you see chorioamnionitis in a woman that's like delivering a child, think about Ureaplasma urolyticum as a potential etiology, right? And the thing is, the reason why it's very important to know about this is that there's actually been a lot of studies that have come out that have shown that actually, if a woman has chorioamnionitis from Ureaplasma, it actually increases the risk of the newborn needing like prolonged intubation and mechanical ventilation, right? Basically, Ureaplasma causes a lot of amniotic fluid problems. And I mean, it also raises risk for many other things like preterm labor, preterm delivery, right? And one clue that you may see in a question, especially in a person that has a UTI from Ureaplasma urolyticum, is that the urine pH will be high. Because remember, Ureaplasma is actually a urease. I mean, it's kind of easy to remember this, right? It's a urease positive bug, right? And one thing to keep in mind is that Ureaplasma urolyticum, right, with all these like complications that can arise where the newborn ends up needing like prolonged intubation, mechanical ventilation, it can actually raise the child's risk of like bronchopulmonary dysplasia, right? It can raise the child's risk of like neonatal pneumonia. And again, it's transmitted obviously, right, from mom to baby. And the thing is, like, Ureaplasma can even cause things like PID, cause things like miscarriages, right? So, and you may say, okay, Divine, how do we treat this stuff? Well, we treat it with doxycycline, or you can also use like azithromycin, right? So you can treat it with doxycycline or azithromycin. The thing is, you cannot use a cell wall inhibitor because the thing is, Ureaplasma does not have a cell wall, right? It's kind of like mycoplasma. It doesn't have a cell wall. So a penicillin-based agent is not going to do squat for you, right? So again, you may say, Devon, you're devoting so much time to Ureaplasma. Ureaplasma is a very, very high-yield bug to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams. And one last thing I'll say is, if a woman has chorioamnionitis, that is not an indication for C-section. I see people make this mistake all the time on the NBME exams. Chorioamnionitis, if a woman has chorio, you don't want to, you know, let the baby kind of like sit and chill there. No, you want to go ahead and deliver the baby, right? But that does not mean that you need to do a C-section, right? You know, just proceed towards delivery. Like if mommy is not having enough contractions, give her oxytocin or give her a prostaglandin, right? You want to deliver the baby soon, but you don't have to do a C-section for chorioamnionitis, okay? That's a very common mistake that people make on the USMLE exams. And then the final thing I will say, I promise, is that You want to be able to recognize amniotic fluid embolism, right? So amniotic fluid embolism on MBME exams, right, will present as like a woman that, you know, around the process of delivery, she becomes unresponsive, or she has like a low platelets, like a thrombocytopenia. Her fibrin split products will be elevated, right? She may have like an elevation like PTT and PT, stuff like that, right? So those are kind of like big things you want to be able to recognize. And as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer like both large group and one-on-one tutoring for step one, step two CK, step two CS, and step three. Preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, if you're preparing for the ABIM board exam, the medicine in training exam, or you're a college student, I need tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, physics, biochem, histology, physiology. I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you need like application advising, right, for like, you know, like ERAS applications if you're applying to residency, or AMCAS applications if you're applying to med school, I do offer like one-on-one like advising with like, you know, like rec letters, personal statements, editing applications, mock interviews. I do offer all those things. I mean, I've worked with tons of people, and I actually have admissions committee experience. I was actually an admissions committee member at a top 2 med school for a year. So I've reviewed thousands of high quality applications, right? So so just something to keep in mind. So if you need any of these things, just either reach out to me through the website, right? Or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end, at gmail.com. And then, as I said in a much earlier podcast, these podcasts are now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, stuff like that, right? So whatever podcast app that floats your boat, you can actually get these podcasts there. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Please listen to this podcast before you take your USMLE Step 2 CK exam. It's a very high-yield one. And I mean, I'm going to bring out some more high-yield podcasts down the line. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Thank you.